Hi, welcome back to Youskogans, the International Law Podcast. We are finally back after 510 days of a self-imposed hiatus. Now I am back with two more members of the podcast, Faris Athar and Shayan Ahmed. And today we are going to be talking about IHL clinics. And we'll be talking to Dr. Robert Heinz, who is an associate professor of public international law at the Grotius Center for International Legal Studies at Leiden University. He's also the director of its LLM program on international law. He's also the director of the KGF Forum. I won't pronounce the actual name of the forum because I can't, on international humanitarian law. And he also runs, he's the director of the IHL clinic at the KGF Forum. We'll be talking with reference to Dr. Heinz's article on the educational value of international humanitarian law clinics, the examples of Leiden and Bochum. Thank you so much, Dr. Heinz, for taking out time and being on this podcast with us today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here and to be able to talk to you about this, for me, very important topic, international humanitarian law clinics, because it's something I really believe in, and it's great that it has attracted some attention. So I'm very happy to talk to you about this new method of teaching international humanitarian law.
Oh, great to hear that. I think Faris has a question to start us off, and then we'll take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, Dr. Heinz, it's lovely to see you, and it's great to have you on. I think I speak on behalf of the whole team when we say that, you know, we really appreciate you taking the time out to be here with us. And also, just as a sidebar, I hope you and your family are safe and healthy in these incredibly uncertain times. So yeah, I really, really appreciate you being here. So I think I'll start with a question about generally the normative foundations of clinical legal education. So could you perhaps talk a little bit more about the normative foundations of clinical legal education, and also why, or perhaps elaborate upon why it's taken a little bit longer for the advent of legal clinical education to come to Europe as opposed to other academic systems like the United States?
Well, that's already a very profound question, I want to say, and one which is maybe not so easy to answer. Also a question of a lawyer, definitely, because you're asking for the normative basis of clinical legal education. Well, let's put it like this, maybe to start off with a bit of background information on the history of law clinics. In many ways, this is a system which originates in North America, especially the United States of America, where one can say that already decades ago, at the beginning of the last century, there were law schools which started with legal clinics, meaning that they used the theoretical knowledge of the students they acquired during law school in order to help the common people on the street. Yeah, so in a way to give their students the possibility to advise people who could maybe not afford an attorney or a law firm, in order to advise them for normal, maybe simple legal question as, is my house contract, my lease valid? I had an accident with my car, or I'm seeking a residence permit. What do I have to do? And in a way, the idea behind that was always twofold. On the one hand, it gives students this extreme great opportunity to apply law like hands-on to a practical case. So it's not just from a textbook, but on the other hand, to actually help people, to have societal impact, people who might not be able to be able to get legal advice. And so it's a win-win situation. And I think nowadays, currently, every law school in the United States, which thinks that it needs to attract good students, has at least one legal clinic. Usually they have quite a number, like a handful of legal clinics, five, six, or seven, with different specializations. In that regard, for a long time, there was no equivalent for that in continental Europe. The reason behind that, it's difficult to say. It might have something to do with the traditional development of legal education in Europe, in a way that in many countries legal education is built upon like a two-step approach to legal mm-hmm. education. You have the theoretical education at university, and then a lot of countries like France, the UK, Germany, Spain have a certain period of practical legal training. And that's when the law students then get the practical experience. because of that, and because of the fact that European universities very often see themselves as so-called research universities, mm-hmm. which are also giving the possibility to do your PhD, it almost seems like that universities are or were afraid of mixing theory and practice in a way that, at least when I was studying law in Germany 30 years ago, I would not have had the chance to get a lot of practical experience apart from maybe doing like an internship on the side or something. Mm-hmm. But not, it was not part of the legal education. And and at the same time, while I said the universities were maybe hesitant to go into this area because they saw themselves as research universities, I think also the community of fully educated lawyers, judges, prosecutors, and attorneys were maybe hesitant to go down that road and push for this kind of education, because in a way, they might be afraid that students could take away some of their clients, yeah, and say, right. like, we are giving free advice, why should I go to a lawyer in the end? And on top, like the third component saying, yeah, what does it mean with regard to the, what should I say, like the risk of giving wrong legal advice, yeah, mm-hmm. who's carrying that? Because in the end, obviously, we have to understand that students are not yet fully qualified. So it's obvious that they can't know everything. So that might be different factors why Europe took a bit longer to pick up on this kind of legal education. And in that regard, for me, maybe I had the advantage on the one hand that I spent a couple of years or some time at least in both the US and United Kingdom, mm-hmm. Being open to different approaches to legal education. And on top of that, in our area, in international law, the borders or the basis for education might be a bit different, because in the end, to become an international lawyer, there is not something like passing an international bar exam or mm-hmm. something. It doesn't exist.
Right.
Any student, and you know that maybe best, who wants to become an international lawyer and practice, mm-hmm. has usually only one option: do their national training, national education, then maybe do an international LLM, and then fight their way through by right. doing internships, etc. And I think that's where I picked up the ball in a certain way 8 years ago when we created the Leiden IHL Clinic, because I had worked in practice before. I had many, many contacts, especially in the NGO world, the Red Cross, Red Crescent Societies, the International Committee of the Red Cross, human rights NGOs, etc. So I had seen how international law works in practice, and I worked as the then director of the master program and the director of the Karlshofen-Rieskes Forum on International Humanitarian Law. And the idea of the Karlshofen-Rieskes Forum, or the KGF as we call it, was always to be based on three pillars: education, practical dissemination, and research. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I thought, after 1 year, we created it in 2011, it would be great to combine those three, like right. have research inspire teaching, inspire practice, and the other way around, because right. then all three components can learn from each other. And at that time, I had a couple of alumni who had just graduated from the program, from the Public International Law program in Leiden. And I asked them what they were thinking about this opportunity and whether they would be willing to help me with setting up such a clinic. And everyone, and I know part of you, you had these colleagues, everyone was extremely energetic and motivated. Mm-hmm. And so that was the starting shot of the Leiden IHL clinic. But it was at that point something which didn't really have a role model in Europe. So I was at the beginning, especially I had to persuade people that this makes sense.
Dr. Heinsch, it's interesting that you talk about the traditional legal clinic model, which has been around for some time. But in my understanding, the traditional legal clinic model mainly dealt with providing legal services and advice to individuals and people who could not afford quality legal opinions. How do you think that the IHL clinic model differs from the traditional clinic model that developed in the US, as you said? Because it seems, even in the article that you mentioned, that it's mostly research-based, in which you work with partner organizations on a specific legal issue or problem. So how do you understand the IHL clinic model?
Yeah, well, so I knew about the US American role model. I also was in contact with colleagues who had set up human rights law clinics in the US, or refugee law clinics, where even in those circumstances, the individual is at the center of the clinic, because it's about like maybe one individual needing to get advice on how they can pursue their claim against the state, etc. In that regard, international humanitarian law, in the same way as traditional general public international law, is still not, let's put it like this, not 100% focused on the individual. It's still about the obligations of states. And while this has changed in recent years with the development of international criminal law, where suddenly it's about individual criminal responsibility and then what the individual has done. Nevertheless, international humanitarian law originally was set up as by treaties agreed upon by states. In that regard, and the main players are also states. So when I started the first year of the clinic, I approached three organizations, the Netherlands Red Cross, the German Red Cross, which is also my former employer. I worked there as an IHL legal advisor. And then the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, a small or medium-sized human rights NGO located in Berlin, which does strategic litigation cases. And I knew that usually these players working in the human rights, humanitarian law sector don't have a lot of resources. It's not that they have like a big corporate law firm, 10 associate lawyers or 50 associate lawyers. They might have one legal advisor specialized on IHL, or maybe two. So I talked with them, and in the first year, like all three of these gave me two projects each, because they thought this is a great idea. We have either some abstract question we want to get research, for example, in order to pursue some lobby work, in order to present our views better on the international sphere, or to prepare a case in order to see, well, maybe there's a reason why in a recent conflict situation IHL violations have been committed. And we don't have so much infrastructure, but if you have a team of four or maybe five or six students, they can do initial research, they can do the factual research, and then they can analyze this against the IHL background. So in that regard, it took us quite a while until we had the first individuals coming to us and asking for legal advice, mainly because in the area of international humanitarian law, the actors are different. Yeah, it's international organizations, it's the Red Cross, it's government agencies, or NGOs. It might be that nevertheless, individuals are very much affected by that. So just one of the examples, last December, the European Center for Constitution and Human Rights submitted a communication to the ICC the International Criminal Court about weapons deliveries to Saudi Arabia in the context of the Yemen conflict and possible IHL violations and war crimes. And we helped in many various ways on this way to submitting the communication selecting arguments, selecting facts, giving legal advice, etc. And they then use this knowledge in order to find actual victims, to get more details. And in that regard, although it was an app, it was an organization we worked for, it benefited in the end also the victims of these possible crimes.
Oh, great. It's great that you talk about the development of the model that you did in Leiden and Bochum. Before we move ahead, would it be possible for you to briefly describe the program structure of the IHL clinic model that you have developed at Leiden and Bochum?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I have to say it's probably a bit of a different model in both at both universities because there are different programs. I might start with the Leiden model because that's in the end my home university and where I have now been doing the clinic for the last 8 years. First, we started to offer the IHL clinic to the students of the regular LLM program in public international law once a year. Namely in the winter term. By now we do it twice a year, in the winter and in the spring term. The LLM students in public international law are offered this in order to replace one of their courses, which are part of the public international law program. So this is, that used to be the practicum, which was some sort of a moot court. Last year, we changed it to the Privatissimum. It's a 10 ECTS course, which deals a lot with legal research and applying it to international recent developments. So this fits well. We take usually, I would say, 12 to 18, sometimes 20 students per semester. It depends a bit on the number of projects we have and also the number of supervisors we have at hand, because usually I put those 12 students, for example, into groups of teams of four each. So then if I have 12 students, I divide them into three teams. Each team gets a supervisor and partly even a second senior supervisor in the background. And then they work for this client. They are selected from a pool of sometimes 80 or 100, or we sometimes even had 120 applications. So it's quite competitive. They have to, it's a bit like applying for a job. So I require the same documents. They have to submit their CV, cover letter, and their grades. And then we have interviews because for us, it's important that the people can work together. So it's important that they don't only are great legal minds and have a good motivation, which is important, but it's also important that they are able to have soft skills, that they can work in a team, that they're able to deal with their supervisors properly and the clients. So it's a whole package. And that starts in September. The selection process, 1st of October is usually the kickoff meeting where we present the projects. Usually the clients give like a 2 or 3 pager with the main most important assignments. And then over a period of 3 to 4 months, the students have a series of first lectures and thematical sessions where they learn more about IHL or ICL or human rights law, depending on the projects. And then common seminar sessions in which we, every 2 or 3 weeks, discuss the development of the projects. On top of that, they sometimes have weekly meetings with their direct supervisors where they get advice on how to approach this. And then at the end of the 4 months, they usually prepare a report or case studies or whatever was needed. So this is the Leiden model, and it works similarly now also in the spring semester where I offer it where I offered to the advanced public international law course here at Leiden. In Bochum, it's a bit different. So 2 years ago, I got the offer to be the guest chair for international humanitarian law, international criminal law, and applied legal theory at the Institute for the Law of Armed Conflict at Bochum University. And they have a master in humanitarian action. So it's about humanitarian assistance and all things related to conflict, disaster, and how to help people in this context. It's an inter-European master. And the students there are not necessarily all lawyers. So it might be also that they're doctors, medical doctors, engineers, managers, etc. And they need to do also law courses. And so there's a practical section or course on applying international law. But that's usually only 6 weeks. And I extended it, I think, to up to 2 months. So the period is much shorter than in Leiden. And obviously the background of the students is differently. But there are also usually 18 or 20 students. So I split them up into groups of six. And then I found assignments which were maybe more related to humanitarian assistance, humanitarian action, or certain areas which are dealing more with their expertise. I usually didn't here in Leiden by now, I have like a system of or a team of probably 5 to 6 supervisors who are constantly helping me with the clinic. In Bochum, at the beginning, the infrastructure was a bit smaller. I had only 1 or 2 people helping me. So in that regard, then I gave the students themselves more responsibility to coordinate themselves. But this always depends on the circumstances. In the end, the results were usually the same. I have to say, every year I'm always surprised how great students, if you put them together in a team and on a real case, what brilliant work they can produce and how motivated they are. Like, I mean, I'm teaching a lot of other courses where you just have to write exams and papers and I mean, in Leiden, we are gifted in a way that there's always a big crowd of motivated students. But with the clinic, you are always impressed, even as a professor, to see what they can put together. Because sometimes after 4 months, I get a report where I say, I don't see a difference from what like one of my colleagues or myself would produce. So these are a bit the two concepts. And we have exported this concept by now also to other universities. One of my colleagues from Italy, Giulio Bartolini, he spent 6 months at Leiden University and he also worked for the Red Cross before. And then he went back to Rome and set up also an IHL clinic modeled and built after the Leiden idea. A year later, I had a colleague from Egypt, Mr. Ahmed Khalifa, Dr. Ahmed Khalifa. He came also 6 months to Leiden and helped me set up the clinic in Bochum. Now he went back to Egypt and set up an IHL clinic at the German University in Cairo. Last June, I was with my PhD fellow, Sophia, in Jordan, in Amman. And we explained to a group of 7 colleagues from the Middle East what we are doing in Leiden. And as a result, now a new IHL clinic in Amman was created 4 months ago. I think they're now working on a new clinic also in Palestine and in Beirut. So it's spreading, this idea.
Great. Well, that was a very comprehensive overview of the models that we have used. I think that'll help ground the discussion better for the remaining part of the podcast. I'll hand over to Shayan, I think, who has a follow-up question.
So, Dr. Hainch, from the standpoint of students, what legal skills do you hope to instill in them in order to make them better humanitarian lawyers for the future? And also, how through these clinics do you seek to bridge the gap between theory and practice in terms of international humanitarian law?
Can you repeat the last half sentences?
What? So, So how do you, through these clinics, how do you seek to bridge the gap between theory and practice in terms of international humanitarian law?
Good. Maybe I answer that question first. So how do I imagine to bridge the gap between theory and practice is obviously always in international law a good question. Yeah, because there are probably a lot of people outside in the world who say, is international law actually law? Is it not just politics, power politics, especially? How can we enforce international law? Well, I think the last 20, 25 years has shown have shown that through the development of international courts and tribunals, enforcement has become much better. It's not perfect. And especially in the area of IHL, there are definitely things to improve. But by giving the opportunity every year, every semester to 12, 16 or 20 students at our faculty to learn about IHL, to help other organizations to apply IHL in practice, what is happening is that we are creating a whole movement, a whole group of new international humanitarian lawyers who get excited about the fact that international humanitarian law can help the victims of war to protect them better. So my impression is, and my experience after 8 years of doing the IHL clinic in Leiden, that quite a number of our alumni from the clinic afterwards continue to go on to partly work for these organizations. By now we have alumni who are working for the ICRC in Geneva and Brussels, who work for their foreign ministry here in The Hague, for example, who work for organizations like the European Center for Constitutional on Human Rights, and who have also moved to the ICC or the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. So by now, actually, the clinic alumni are spreading all over the world in a way. And we had even alumni, one of my recent alumni from last year, Alexandre Nicolet, a French student. He went back to Paris and created his own IHL clinic at Paris Panthéon Assas. In a way, it's like apart from teaching those students what IHL should be applied to in practice, it's also using them as or developing multiplicators, yeah, people who spread the knowledge of IHL and help to apply it better. So it's it started small. But by the fact that we are not the only IHL clinic nowadays, back then when I started the clinic, there was only one other IHL clinic in the US at Emory Law School, which started actually 3 or 4 years before the Leiden one by my colleague Laurie Blank. But by now, we have also initiatives in South America, in Asia, in Africa, in North America, in Canada. So by setting up this kind of new tool of IHL clinic education, I think we are reaching a lot of young people who then go on to advise their governments, advise their organizations, and maybe go to the field to help apply IHL. So it's a thing to not only teach people, but also to motivate people and maybe show them. And that's also the idea, of course, behind that. As a master student, you probably chose this idea to do a public international law master because you wanted to maybe contribute a bit to a more peace in the world, to a better situation in conflict situations. But maybe you didn't know how to do that because, like, to be honest, these jobs are not around the corner. Maybe they're around the corner if you're living in The Hague like I do, because like the Peace Palace is 10 minutes from here. But for many other people, there are hardly any options to work in this area. By joining the IHL clinic, they get options. Yeah, they see, there's the Red Cross is doing that. This NGO is doing that. The government also deals with international humanitarian law. So, and then they get contacts. They learn about people who are giving them the assignments and say, like, how did you manage to get this position? How did you get into that post? And maybe also some of my clients then get interested in the students and say, I know that name. They worked at Robert's IHL clinic in Leiden. I take them as an intern. So it's there are various components which help, I think, to transfer the knowledge of IHL from theory to practice.
Absolutely. I think, Dr. Hines, that was a fantastic answer. And speaking as a Leiden Clinic alumnus myself, I can guarantee that the kind of exposure and interaction that you get at the clinic is the yields are immense. And having had to work with the Coalition for the ICC after the clinic and now working in the private sector in the Netherlands, I think it's phenomenal how useful and how frequently I get to use the skills I acquired in the clinic at Leiden. So we'll definitely convert for everything that you said. In advance to that question, I had a follow-up question, because you talked about the importance of dissemination and having students, practitioners, and the public at large, I think, wanting to be more aware about IHL, or that's the objective. So my question is, how effective has the IHL clinic been as a platform for disseminating IHL? And how has the clinic linked up with partner organizations such as the ICRC, to firm the aim of awareness in general, I think?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's always a tricky answer, question to answer, because I'm a lawyer, I'm not a social scientist, which does empirical studies, although I actually studied also partly social sciences, sociology. So what kind of impact we have? It's obviously my personal evaluation impression. So there's probably maybe one project which is the best way to illustrate what kind of impact we can have. And you talked about our partner organizations. About 5 years ago, I got in contact with my American colleague, Laurie Blank, at Emory Law School, and my Israeli colleague Yael Diaz-Gersman at IDC Herzliya. And at that moment, we were first surprised that there are other people who have IHL clinics. So we met each other, and then we thought, oh, this is great. Can't we do something together? And the first thing we did is that we thought maybe it's good to bring the students, our IHL clinic students, together once a year for like 5 days and have like IHL clinic exchange conferences. And that was a bit of an ambitious endeavor, because we needed to fly people across the Atlantic, etc. Mm-hmm. But we were so lucky that we got external funding for this. And 5 years ago, we had the first conference in Tel Aviv, where the American, the Leiden, and the Israeli students came together. And as of then, we also thought maybe it would be good to have a project together. And since I had long-standing ties to the Red Cross and the ICRC in Geneva, I contacted one of my former colleagues there. And he thought, Vincent Bernard from the ICRC, he thought, well, we would like, he was the editor-in-chief of the International Review, and he said, we are currently thinking about how can we present IHL better and find proof that IHL is working in practice, that it's complied with. Because that was like during the Syria conflict, people were talking about IHL is not complied with anymore. And then we came up with the idea to have a complete new approach and look for positive examples of compliance with IHL. In contrast to what we do here in The Hague, prosecute the war criminals. And we started with those three clinics, and then expanded it to the Italian clinic at Roma Tre, and last year also the Bochum clinic in Germany. And we asked the students to find real-life examples from the battlefield where IHL was complied with. And after 3 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, I think, September 2017, I want to say, we launched a database which is available now online, which is called IHL in Action, and you can Google it and find it there. And it provides like a world map of conflicts. I mean, that's sad enough because you see all the conflicts. Right. But then you can click on these conflicts and then you can find examples where IHL was complied with, meaning civilians were protected, prisoners of war were treated properly, dead bodies were exchanged in order to give them to their families. Means and methods of conflict, means and methods of hostilities were complied with. So, and this is now becoming very popular because finally there is also something which shows IHL is actually applicable. So this is one good example because it's also publicly available. During the time, we did a lot of work for NGOs in different situations, helping them to do factual and legal analysis, which prepared then court cases, either in a national jurisdiction or an international jurisdiction. So we had cases which we supported both in national jurisdictions and which led to finding people guilty of committing a crime. Mm-hmm. And we help people to support communication to the ICC, things which are still pending, but right. which started a project, a process which was like gigantic, one has to say, like 250 pages of report, etc. Mm-hmm. We now this year had two amicus curiae briefs to the ICC and the Special Jurisdiction for Peace in Colombia. So the ICC amicus was on the situation in Palestine. The Special Jurisdiction for Colombia obviously had to deal with the civil war there. So, and on top of that, we helped Red Cross national societies to support their cause when they are negotiating on an international level on like current issues like cyber warfare, lethal autonomous weapons, etc. So it's difficult to put that in numbers. We also helped one Ministry of Defense with drafting their military manual bringing together like all the views which were available on certain problems in international humanitarian law. So on different levels, different possibilities of impact. You see some examples on our website. Unfortunately, quite a number of the reports are confidential. So it's more something where I can tell you it was a recent conflict situation, but I can't tell you which one.
Right. Well, thank you for that.
I think we'll do the guessing. I hope Forrest was one of those motivated students that you talk about.
Definitely, yes. Yeah.
Unfortunately, being a spring student, I was unable to apply for the clinic. I will always regret that fact. But nevertheless, it's interesting that you talk about the confidentiality of the reports, because you talk about your connections and your references while you were establishing the IHL clinic at Leiden and Bochum. But for an independent researcher or for somebody else, for example, currently I'm helping an international organization in Pakistan to help to establish IHL clinics in Pakistan. How would you approach these humanitarian actors and organizations to engage with students on such sensitive and confidential data? Because if I look on the website of the KGF forum, only one report on a responsible approach towards data that is publicly available from around 30 projects of the clinic so far. So given that that the information that you're dealing with is so sensitive and confidential, it might be a difficult job to convince these actors to actually allow undergraduate or even graduate students to work on these projects.
Well, first of all, since last week, So like 5 days ago, we now have two additional reports online, the two amicus briefs, which we just uploaded. And obviously the IHL in Action project reports are all available online. So out of those 35, 36 reports, I would say 1/3 by now is publicly available. But good question. The confidentiality is key. Very important is that every student, before actually learning about what kind of assignment they are getting, have to sign a special confidentiality agreement where it becomes clear that they are not allowed to talk to anyone about the project, give away any kind of information they're inquiring during this the time of the writing of the report. And we take this very seriously because obviously this are sometimes very sensitive issues on conflicts which are still ongoing. Sometimes it's referring to individuals which might be harmed because of that if something comes out. Of course, it's a balancing act, but with 8 years of experience, I can say, due to our very rigorous selection process, we only take students where we have the feeling, okay, they are not only great legal minds and have the necessary theoretical qualifications, but they are also good human beings and have a decent character where we can trust that when they sign this confidentiality agreement, they keep this confidential. And in the last 8 years, I can't report of any moment. We had once a client who came back to me and said, like, someone who worked for us actually put this in their CV, which is obviously tempting. Yeah, you want to talk about, or like at least indicate that you worked on such interesting thing in order to make you also interesting for possible employers. But then he said, but I have to say it was not a Leiden student. And I said, no, because like the Leiden students usually come to me and say, what can I write? And then I say, well, you can say, okay, it's a complicated legal issue for recent conflict, and maybe one or two other criteria which don't clarify who the client is. But in general, the main idea is we are helping in order to help these organizations, to help the imp, to help the victims of often these crimes, the IHL violations. And we are not doing this in order to become famous. And in that regard, it's sometimes hard for me because we are putting a lot of effort into this, and then only have 30 reports there, and there's like only one or two public available. Sometimes my colleagues ask, what are you doing, Robert? Are you working at all? And I'm like, I might be working more than a lot of normal academic colleagues, but I can't publish it, which is very weird for an academic not to publish it. But the idea is to help people, and on the long term, I think this has been shown successful, because that's also the thing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but nowadays, as a student, very often I was like an anonymous figure among like 500 law students, so I didn't feel like noticed in my legal education. Within our clinic, everyone counts, and you're taken seriously, even if you're like the student researcher helping in the clinic. And that shows also by that you have to sign this confidentiality agreement. And by giving you this importance, I think it also makes clear that you comply with this in order to help the organization we are working for. And that also makes maybe a difference. I try to always bring the students in contact with our client, with our cooperation partner, because if you have that personal relationship, you understand why you should not be talking to this, even to your girlfriend or boyfriend or a partner or something. Yeah. So, and that makes all the difference. Yeah. But in the end, the short answer is everyone has to sign a confidentiality agreement when they work on a confidential project. And until now, I have the feeling this has worked quite well.
Forrest, before you ask your question, just before starting this podcast, Forrest was a little concerned with using Zoom because of its privacy concerns. Yeah. Because apparently he has sensitive data from his clinic project 2 years ago, and he still hasn't.
Yeah. So all my reports,
which organization you worked with, I've tried asking him many times, but he still refused to tell me.
I was just about to add to what Dr. Hynch said, and as a student's perspective, if somebody's already done this, the motivation, like Dr. Hynch said, is not because, oh, I worked for this big organization, or I did this kind of work. I think the drive primarily is the motivation to, at a very young or early stage of a budding career, be able to contribute to actors and organizations who are actively making a difference. And I think that's really the drive and motivation, and seeing how hard the clinic's working, how hard Dr. Hynch is working in anonymity with a whole sort of diverse bunch of individuals and academics and students and researchers doing such a fantastic job. I think you owe it to yourself and to everyone around you and your colleagues to not disclose such information.
And as I said, usually I have a good sense for people who don't get that. And that's, I should maybe not say that publicly because now people will not do it anymore. But sometimes there are people, when I ask them in the interview, why are you doing that? And they literally say, yeah, because it's good for my CV. And I'm like, okay, there's the door. Yeah, because that's not what it is about.
Yeah, not very subtle.
So one of the questions which I had was, so in Bochum, you have this interdisciplinary master's program. And on the other hand, you have Leiden, which is specifically centered around law students.
Yeah.
So which... Can and everyone hear me?
So
which of these two clinics would you prefer in terms of the work ethic? Because I say this because there's a socio-political aspect to the work that is being done in the clinics. So how beneficial is it to have students which are non-lawyers contribute to a sort of a predominant legal discussion or a legal research which is happening in the clinic?
Not an easy question. I want to also separate that maybe into two aspects. The one thing, like the political aspects of conflicts and how does that interfere with our work, or how does that inform our work? And then what is the difference between having only lawyers working on something? Although I have to say in Leiden, we also partly admit people who have a political science background or international relations background and have done like additional legal qualifications afterwards. So they also have a mixed background. But let's put it like this. First thing, the political aspects of a conflict and the research we are doing. I mean, this is probably the prime example of what you don't learn from a textbook of international law. Yeah, that things are not black and white. It's not about like, it's a clear case of violation of common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, or it's not. The students, when they work on these cases, need to learn that as a lawyer, you of course need to learn the law, but you also need to learn how to evaluate factual circumstances and to understand. And that's usually when we work on a conflict situation, the first 2 weeks, students are always asked to just understand the background of the conflict. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that they know by already look into the legal implications, but rather what has happened, who are the parties, what has contributed to the conflict. They need to use that language and transfer it, or these results, and transfer it to the legal background. And this is something I think any good lawyer needs to learn at one point to make that connection between the facts on the ground, and these might be politically influenced, yes or no, and the theoretical framework which I want to apply to these facts. And I think that's the beauty of the clinic. It offers you this opportunity already during your studies. You don't have to work a couple of years until you come to work on one of these cases yourself, but you can already do that during your studies and understand that it might be it might sound easy to decide whether this is an international or non-international armed conflict in theory. I mean, even in theory, it doesn't sound easy, but in practice, it might be so much more complicated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this is a skill then they learn. Does it help to have an interdisciplinary crowd or interdisciplinary students working on this? It depends a bit on what kind of case or assignment you're working on. Yeah, so I think I have experienced that assignments which have a more global approach in a way that also like a situational analysis is important or certain new ideas have to come up, then it helps if you have this interdisciplinary background. So then it's maybe helpful to have a medical doctor or an engineer explaining you how certain things work and completely thinking outside of the box in many ways. And some of the examples we did for the IHL in Action project, this was really helpful also because in Bochum, comparable to Leiden, but in Bochum specifically, a lot of the students also come from conflict situations. So they have firsthand experience and then they bring this experience to the table. So that's great. At the same time, if we want to write communication or prepare to help to write communication to the ICC, it's about jurisdictional questions, the question of admissibility or the elements of crimes. And in the end, that's the reason why we are educated as lawyers. That's not easy to answer. And that's also something, even if I do my best to give introductory lectures on IHL and ICL, it's usually not something you learn within like 3 or 4 weeks. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if I have like a very legal and especially procedural assignment, then it might be very helpful to have a team of full-fledged law students mm-hmm. available. Yeah, but it's a question of choosing the right project. Both can be very inspiring, up to a point that I now also took one of my former Bochum students and hired him as a guest researcher here in Leiden, and he spent just like 4 months at the KGF. So there's also now an overlap between those two master programs. So I hope I answered both questions. Yes, I did. Yes.
Yeah. So this leads me to a very contemporary question that we have. So the model from my understanding seems to be one which requires a lot of in-person contact with the groups meeting, the teams meeting with the supervisors. So with the issue of the coronavirus, so how do you see it differing now in terms of the structure that you've already explained in terms of the clinic?
Yeah, you're touching upon a very obviously interesting issue and yeah. Something I had to deal with during the last 6 or 7 weeks. As you say, the clinic, as I set it up, both in Leiden and in Bochum, was always based on close social interaction. Yeah, so. As I said, in Leiden, we have always two supervisors for a team of 4 students. We have seminar sessions, we have lectures, we have individual coaching and supervision meetings. And that was all in person. That was in class or that was, yeah. And now what we had to do, I have currently 20 IHL clinic students, mainly from the advanced master in public international law. I had to transfer the whole infrastructure, the whole setup, both of the seminar sessions as well as of the supervision structure to an online platform. Yeah, in a way that, but that's something we had to do now at the university in general. So we got also support for that. But let's put it like this, Zoom is my best friend by now, so you understand why I have a paid subscription here, because I want to say I learned already during that time when I was teaching both in, at Leiden. I was still the director of the Leiden IHL clinic, but I built up the Bochum IHL clinic. And there were moments when I remember one day where we started both clinics at the same time on a Monday. It might have been stupid scheduling from my side, but it happened like this. Yeah. And so I opened the Bochum clinic via Skype here from The Hague in the morning. And then 2 hours later, I went to the campus here in The Hague and opened it in person. And in the evening, took the train to Bochum to then take over doing everything in person in Bochum. So in some ways, now I want to say we have the advantage of living in a time where we can actually talk to each other and not be in the same place. Yeah. So the four of us would not have this conversation 20 years ago, probably not even 10 years ago. Yeah. But at the moment, it's actually okay. I mean, I even learn more about you than I usually would if we would meet at the campus. I would not get an insight into your private apartment or your office or whatever. Yeah. And vice versa. Yeah. You would not realize that I have like a black and white blanket lying here or things like that.
It's looking really nice.
Yeah, I cleaned up. Yeah, so that's a good thing.
It looks great.
No, but obviously there are some challenges and I'm missing a bit the personal contact because as far as hopefully knows, I like working with students. I like teaching. But I also like doing that because I get immediate feedback. Yeah, and I do my best in order to accommodate everyone as much as possible. And that's difficult. So we used at the beginning one software where actually we realized I had 20 students in the room or in the virtual room, but the software was not stable enough. And then we 18 people switched off their video, and then I was only talking and the person who was presenting their results was having the video on. And that I made one time, but that's not for me. Yeah. No, so we found a different software, which is better and where actually everyone can be on the screen. Yeah, it has some advantages, I want to say. We should not neglect that. There are now some people who actually went home to their home country. So I have a clinic student now, and a clinic student now who is currently in Brazil. The other one is in Australia. The only problem we have is when we meet all together, we need to find a time which is valid in all three time zones. Yeah, so like spending pretty much 22 hours of time zone in the world. Wow. So which usually leaves only the hours around lunch or shortly after lunch. So in Brazil, the colleague has to wake up early, and in Australia, the colleague is almost going to bed afterwards. But it's possible. It's the same way as everyone is dealing with now. Like I have weekly staff meetings with my team where I get updates on how the projects are going from my supervisors or from my supervision team. And then we have our classes with the students online. And otherwise, I mean, even before, a lot of the supervision is, of course, also sending drafts to the supervisors who then proofread the drafts and send back the comments. Yeah. So in the end, we live in a modern world. And in the same way with the clients. Yeah. So now we have Skype talks with clients. We had that already before because our clients come from all over the world. And then we have Skype talks or Zoom talks. And we now do that like, 100%. The clinic is now virtually online. I hope at one point I can see the people again in person. But at the moment, we are coping with that as well as possible. Yeah.
I hope you're being generous with the deadlines for the students, because that's very important. And mad respect to you for working hard during these challenging times.
Absolutely.
I'm sure your students are missing your jokes, and you're pacing around from one corner of the room to the other corner.
You know me. That's and you're bringing actually the emphasis on the one thing I'm missing most. It's like this running around from one corner of the room to another. which is difficult because you can't do that with like your headset. I could have running into something.
Also, I'd like to apologize to all of you and the audience as well for changing positions and darkening up. I had a little technical difficulty. I had to charge my laptop, so I apologize for that.
Yeah, we being in Pakistan don't have any technical difficulties, but you being in Rotterdam... thank you so much, Dr. Heinz. Before we let you go, there's one last question. We have already taken a lot more time of yours than we said we would. But I hope you found some meaning in this. So I just want to talk a little bit about the global IHL clinic network, which I'm also a part of. As you said that currently you have this association of five or six universities around the globe, which also do the annual exchange conferences for the IHL clinics. So how do you see the role of the Global IHL Clinic Forum in terms of increasing the number of clinics and in dissemination of IHL in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. If I would know the complete answer, first of all, if I want to give the complete answer, it would take probably another hour. So
we don't mind.
I try to keep myself short also because it's something which I have to say, I have a vision where this is going, but I also learned over the last couple of years that some things just develop by itself. And in that regard, so at the moment, today was actually a good day to have this conference call because we just submitted a funding application for 4 more years of exchange conferences today with my partner university.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Well, like if we get the money, then you can give me congratulations. At the moment, things have changed because at the beginning, literally there were three partners, Emory Law School in Atlanta, IDC Herzliya in Israel, and Leiden University. It has now grown. And thanks to the fact that I think Leiden has a very good position in the world as A, a law school, but B, also close to The Hague, to the institutions. And see the fact that I like to travel around and help other people set up clinics. We have now these different areas, like especially quite a number of colleagues in the Middle East who are setting up IHL clinics, also inspired by the Swedish human rights organization Diakonia. We have contacts in Africa, in South America, in Asia, also thanks to this Bochum student who just established contacts to colleagues in Asia. And our idea is, in the end, or my vision would be to have in 5 or in 10 years IHL clinics on every continent and have maybe at least one IHL clinic in every country of the world, like national Red Cross or Red Crescent societies, as a hub, as a center for disseminating and giving practical legal advice on international humanitarian. This is extremely ambitious in a way that I'm saying at the moment, I would not know how to coordinate all this. We have another funding application in the pocket where we think about setting up Leiden as like a global hub for this IHL movement, IHL clinic movement, helping, and this was also part of the submission we did today, the funding. The idea is that the existing clinics want to develop best practices on how a clinic can be set up, how it can be conducted, how you can acquire clients and cooperation partners, how you supervise projects, etc. And then share that free of charge to anyone who is interested in that. And at the same time, give support for the existing clinics. So that might be small support, like the colleague in Jordan asked me whether at the opening of his clinic I could get, speak some words, which I did via Skype at that time. I didn't fly back to Jordan a second time, but I did this via Skype. I did the same thing in, at Roma Tre, but then flying there, I had now colleagues, again, partly alumni from Leiden, who set up IHL, ICL clinic at Edinburgh University. I helped them by getting in contact with my alumni from the clinic and my past supervisors to help them as external supervisors. Whoever approaches me, or who now we have set up this website where you can register on this global IHL clinic network. And whoever approaches me, we try to provide expertise to. But at the moment, we are doing this with a small team of PhD students, student assistants, and colleagues from the Grosje Center and the KGF. At the moment, these colleagues are mainly here to help me with the supervision of the clinic. If we want to coordinate this global IHL clinic network, it would on the long run be necessary to hire new people, and also to have a coordinator, like an executive director, whose expertise might not be law but maybe communication and networking, etc. At the moment, we take it day by day and month by month, and take the opportunity of that, like one of my former colleagues at the ICC now is the IHL legal advisor for Diakonia in Beirut, and she helped me supervising one of the projects here, and is now spreading the word in the Middle East in a way that it's almost like amazing that in 7-8 countries people are interested in setting up IHL clinics. Sometimes it's also just word of mouth. People hear about this and say, oh, okay, in Leiden it seems to be very busy with regard to IHL clinic activities, maybe they can help us. And for me, it's due to my Red Cross background. I for the last 25 years I worked as a volunteer for the Red Cross, where I think like IHL dissemination is a key principle, and for me it's like I want to give this quality education to our Leiden students, because I used to be the director of the LLM program here, and there's a certain connection. Mm-hmm. But it's also a brilliant idea to say, why not offer this worldwide? Yeah, and by offering it worldwide, actually having an impact we can't even dream of. Yeah, because it's a bit like if I take 20 students per semester, I can have here in Leiden, I have 40 students per year. That's a nice number. But if we think about the fact that we have 10 IHL clinics and multiply that by 10, we have 400 students per year. If we have, 20, 30, 40, 50 clinics in the world, this is getting an impact where we can say maybe that can have an effect on how IHL is applied in practice, how victims are protected in armed conflict. So in general, the sky is the limit, but even in this very idealistic area of international humanitarian law, without money, you can't move too far. So until now, a lot of people also helped me on a pro bono basis. Like if you look on our website, you have more than 50 young colleagues who over the last 8 years dedicated part of their time for free to the supervision of these projects. I would have not been able to create all this without these very motivated young colleagues. But now we are reaching a point where we need also infrastructure. We are working on that. As I said, we just submitted a funding application. Hopefully in the future this is going to get further, because I think it's one of these rare moments where you have a win-win situation. The students learn something for their life, for their practical training, they benefit for their career, the organizations learn or get input, valuable reports that they can use for their work. Victims benefit from this. And as a teacher, as a professor, I benefit in a way that I have the feeling I can inspire young people and at the same time have a practical impact. So there are still a lot of things to do. In that regard, I'm also happy always to talk about this. So yep. Thanks for me. Thank you guys for giving me that opportunity today, because if people hear this, maybe they get interested. And that's also the beautiful thing. I learned, I had this idea 8 years ago to set this up, but by now I have so many people helping me who come up with ideas I would never have, or not on my own. And so it's a creative mass of motivated people. And that's obviously beautiful, because you feel a bit like a pioneer. And sometimes when I have moments when I think it's getting too hard, or I'm exhausted, I don't want to continue with that, then I have colleagues, staff members, team members who say, no, I have this idea, let's do this. Or Robert, we don't need you. We do it on our own. And that's the great thing.
Brilliant. On that positive note, during these gloomy times, thank you so much, Dr. Heinz, for taking out time. It was an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. I hope you feel the same way about us. If you have any parting thoughts about IHL clinics or the podcast or anything else, yeah, you can, the floor is yours.
Yeah, maybe just emphasizing what I ended up with in my last statement. And maybe being a bit more direct, so everyone who's hearing this and feels somehow motivated to work in international law and not yet knowing what they want to do, there are so many ways to do this and to help. You can come to Leiden, become a student, become a member of the clinic. You can also send me an email about helping me in the supervision of the project, or if you want to do something in your home country or at your home university, you can set up a new project. And it doesn't have to be always like the Leiden model or the Bochum model or whatever mm-hmm. model. I think that the positive aspect of my experience is that you can have something, a new idea, and with a bit of persistence and working together with like-minded people, you can achieve a lot. And I think maybe that's as the final statement. I think the current times with the Corona crisis has also shown us the only way we are going to solve these global problems, be it armed conflicts, natural disasters, or pandemics. The only solution can lie on like working together, and in some way, I even though we are sitting at home nowadays, I get the impression people, a lot of people understand that and realize, okay, we have to connect to our community. Yeah. I have to help my neighbor, and I have to help my grandparents or whoever needs my help. And I think that's maybe a message we can give to everyone today, that's like, think about how you can help others, and be it on the international law level or be it in your neighborhood, mm-hmm. it doesn't make a difference. So
perfect. That's all from us. We'll see you after 2 years.
Yeah, Dr. Just as a parting, I just want to say it was fantastic having you, and brilliant to see that you could take out the time and really, really just talk about something that you're so passionate about. And when we really hope, first of all, we really hope that this gains traction and then people are genuinely interested and look at the kinds of incredible work that the clinic is doing and hopefully contribute to that as well. So yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Great. Thank you for having me. Yeah. It was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Do you have a parting comment?
Yeah, I think so. As someone from all of you combined, as someone who's only studied in Pakistan, the prospects of hearing about these law clinics and these new ideas, so it really excites someone from a national jurisdictional point to have these things to look forward to and to sort of learn them and then go back to your jurisdictions and apply them and sort of proliferate the message. So yeah, that's it from my side.
Yeah. And also just as a last comment, I just want to give kudos, at least from my side, to Omer for organizing this and for trying so hard to you know, take the initiative. And Omer, great job. Thanks, man.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
The pleasure is all mine. And yes, that's it.